Snow clung to the stone at Cactus Castle when the Palatine's men crossed the threshold. It was late December of 1610. They moved through cold rooms with torches and a list of names. Doors opened. Servants were held back. Notes were taken in a quick hand. What the men believed they saw that night would feed a case that grew for centuries. Outside the walls, rumor had already run ahead. Inside, the work was slower. Count the beds. Mark the rooms. Ask who was where and when. The Palatine Georgi Thurzo wanted order on paper. He left with statements, prisoners, and a story that seemed clear on the ground. Then time went to work. A noble woman became a symbol. Witness lines turned into headlines of another age. Claims multiplied as papers changed hands. The question that lingers is simple and heavy. What did the record show before legend rewrote it? Chapter 1. Night at Cactus Castle. Present moment entry. The wind pushed across the hill as the party reached the lower gate of Cactus Castle. It was late December of 1610 in Upper Hungary, now Slovakia. Torches burned low as men from the Palatine's retinue took their places. A steward hurried ahead with keys, then stepped back as orders passed along the line. Inside the first hall, the air was dry and cold. Footsteps carried on stone. They moved in pairs. One read names from a list. Another marked what he saw. A door opened to a dormitory where pallets lay close. A young woman stared and said nothing. The men counted and wrote. In a second room, a brazier was dark and a jug stood by a chair. A guard noted that the floor was clean. These are the small lines that begin a case. Quick bridge to past. For years, the great house had worked under pressure. Ference Nadasty, husband to Elizabeth Bathory, had been away for long campaigns. The estates were wide. Hundreds moved through kitchens, fields, and halls. Discipline in such houses was hard. Punishment for theft or neglect could be severe across the region. Rumors about cruelty rose and fell with the seasons. By the winter of 1610, complaint letters and talk in the counties had reached a point that the Palatine would not ignore. Lived voices. A clerk later wrote that servants were detained for questioning. One said she had carried water to an upper room and feared the Countess's temper. Another said he had heard crying behind a heavy door. A third said she was told to keep her eyes down and her mouth shut. These were not sworn trial transcripts for the Countess herself. They were statements taken around the moment of a high arrest. Each carried fear, status, and the pressure of the hour. Thurzo's own notes aimed at order. Who was present? What was in which room? Whether signs of violence were fresh or old. He did not have a full forensic practice in the modern sense. He had authority, a quill, and men who would act on command. The first product was a paper trail with names and places set against the walls of a winter night. Tension or contrast? Here the split begins. Later centuries would speak of a noble woman bathing in blood. That image does not appear in the first lines taken at the castle. The early record is more narrow. It names rooms, bodies, and servants under watch. It anchors dates. It holds a count that varies by witness and by retelling. It does not show a ritual scene. It shows a raid shaped by the legal tools of its time. There was also power in the hallway. A Palatine could detain. He could seize letters. He could recommend how property should be held while a case moved. Servants understood the stakes. So did lesser nobles who owed favors and feared debts. Every word spoken in that hall moved within that pressure. Reflection that opens a question. By the end of the search, prisoners were ready for transport. Statements were folded. Seals met wax. Outside, the hill sat quiet again. Inside the papers, a story had begun to take form. It was a story of a house described as cruel. It was also a story written by men who stood above the accused in rank and power. What did the record that night truly capture? What did it miss in its rush to secure rooms and names? The pages show a first frame. The legend would come later. The work now is to keep those two apart long enough to see both clearly. Chapter 2. House of rank and hard rules. The house woke before first light. Kitchen fires started low. A bell called hands to the yard. A steward checked tallies for grain and meat. A riding master walked the stalls and spoke to a boy about the tools to clean a hoof. This was the rhythm of a great estate in Upper Hungary. Work moved on lines set by rank, habit, and need. The name Bathory carried weight across counties. The family held land, offices, and bonds that linked them to the crown. Elizabeth Bathory married Ference Nadasty in the late 1570s. The match joined houses and reinforced power. With marriage came duty. Estates needed oversight. Rents needed collection. Letters had to be sent in the right hand and tone. In that world, a noble woman was not idle. She managed in the name of her line. War changed the pulse of the household. Ference spent long periods away on campaign against the Ottomans. News arrived on horseback with lists of the wounded, the dead, and the demands for food and coin. When war pulled men and money outward, pressure turned inward on the places they left behind. Fields still needed labor. Livestock still needed care. In winter, cold pressed in and made tempers short. Estate manuals of the region spoke plainly about order. Servants owed obedience. Overseers enforced rules with fines, confinement, or blows. Harsh discipline was not unique to one house. It was the accepted frame of power in many noble courts. That frame matters when reading any later claim about cruelty or mercy. What counted as normal then would shock a listener now. What crossed the line even in that age is the question that drives this story. The scale of the household shaped every choice. A large castle and its satellite manors required cooks, grooms, laundresses, scribes, gamekeepers, and guards. Supplies moved in wagons over poor roads. Workdays stretched with the season. Winters were long. A noble woman at the head of such a system was both insulated by rank and exposed to blame. If food ran short, it would be said she failed to plan. If punishments fell hard, it would be said she ruled by fear. Power cuts both ways. Account books that survive from similar estates list wages, fines, and purchases down to nails and candles. Such records do not speak in moral judgment. They mark what things cost and who received them. From entries like those, historians build the daily truth of how a house lived. Kitchens bought salt and barley by the barrel. Tailors were paid for uniforms. Midwives received gifts after a birth. Those lines sit beside orders for stocks, locks, and cells. Order and care lived beside threat and force. Voices from the noble tier describe expectations placed on ladies of rank. They were to be pious, competent, and stern. They were to protect household honor. They were to manage accounts in the absence of their husbands and keep the wider kin at ease. A mistake in that role could be read as weakness. A firm hand could be praised as good rule or condemned as cruelty, depending on who told the story and when they told it. Servants saw the same facts from below. Long hours, cold rooms, rules for speech and movement. The difference between a reprimand and a beating could rest on the mood of a superior or the quality of the day's work. Fear was a tool in many houses. It kept time and cut down theft. It also left marks. What marks were common for the age, and what marks showed something more, is the hard line to draw now. Religion shaped conduct and rumor. The region carried both Catholic and Protestant confessions through the late 16th and early 17th centuries. Preachers warned of sin inside grand halls and poor cottages alike. Charity and strictness were both preached as virtues. A noble woman could sponsor a chapel and a school in one season and order hard discipline in the next. The mix would not seem strange to her peers. It looks conflicted to us. Money ran through every corridor. Rents arrived late in bad harvests. Taxes rose with war. Credit tied noble families to crown accounts and to each other. When coin was thin, pressure traveled from the counting room to the yard. Fewer hands did more. Mistakes grew. Punishments followed. In that climate, a complaint could be both genuine and shaped by hunger, fear, or a hope for favor. Power made statements dangerous to give and tempting to use. Language and rank mattered when people spoke about a mistress. Defiant speech from a peasant could draw a charge. Careful praise from a lesser noble could hide a request. Households had their own politics long before any formal inquiry. If a steward lost favor, he might whisper that discipline had turned to cruelty. If a rival house sought advantage, it might frame household disorder as proof of moral rot. The same events could carry two readings depending on who stood close to the fire and who stood at the gate. The role of a woman as master of an estate carried a special edge. Many men did not like to see a woman exercise power outside the expected bounds. A strict lady could be called unnatural. A generous lady could be called soft. Either charge could become fuel. When hunger, war, and local rivalries mixed with gendered suspicion, the path from complaint to accusation shortened. That path did not need a single incident to begin. It needed mood, momentum, and a reason to believe someone would listen. What remains from that daily world are fragments that sketch a house under strain. Winter stores measured in sacks. Livestock counted for tax. Repairs delayed when coin ran short. The names of overseers and maids come and go with seasons of service. Through it all, the image of a lady of rank sits at a desk with papers and seals, then walks a hall to check a room, then hears a report in a low voice. That is the work. The moral weight of how it was done is the burden of history. The point is not to erase harm or to excuse cruelty behind the word custom. The point is to place claims inside the world that made them. A blow in a kitchen is not proof of murder in a tower. A harsh rule for late work is not proof of a ritual. At the same time, the language of custom can hide evil. The line between order and abuse is real. It can be crossed in silence. One line to carry forward is simple. A powerful house framed the stakes that followed. The picture of that power helps explain why later accusations found ground to grow. It also helps explain why some resisted belief. They knew the weight of rank and the reach of envy. They knew how easily a story could be sharpened in a hungry winter. So two readings stand in the hall. In one, rank covered cruelty until the cold night when scrutiny came. In the other, rank drew envy and fear that gathered into a tale and then a charge. Both readings ask us to look hard at the rules of the time and the pressure of war and want. Did status protect a predator? Or did rank attract a charge? Chapter 3, Testimony in the Cold. The door closed against the winter air, and the clerk set his ink. A chair scraped across stone. A servant sat and folded shaking hands. The scribe asked a name, a place of work, and the promise to tell what was known. The room held its breath while the first line was taken down. Across the months of 1610 and 1611, statements were gathered in halls and chambers across Upper Hungary. Some spoke in the castle. Others spoke in nearby towns. Dozens came first, then hundreds. Each statement carried a date, a name, and a short account of what the speaker said they knew. Many voices belonged to the household. Maids described chores in upper rooms. A cook spoke about food sent and food withheld. A stable boy said he carried water and heard crying through wood. Names of alleged helpers appeared again and again. Some were women who worked close to the countess. One man served as a strong hand when orders were harsh. Their roles in the house placed them near the center of fear. Other voices stood outside the house. A pastor repeated what a girl told him before she vanished from service. A tailor said he heard a warning not to send his niece into the castle. A smallholder said a wagon left at dawn and came back light. These lines rested on memory and talk. They show how a rumor becomes a report when authority asks for it. Patterns emerged as pages grew. Some accounts agreed on times of day and rooms used for discipline. Some agreed on the character of certain overseers. A few named the same places where injuries were said to have happened. The overlap gives weight. The gaps open questions. One speaker named a maid as a witness. The maid later said she had only heard of the event and had not seen it. Hearsay moved through the record like cold air through a door frame. A scribe may note it by the phrasing. The speaker says they heard, or they say it was common talk. Or they say a cousin told them. Modern readers feel the floor shift under lines like these. Yet such lines were common in early modern inquiries. They fill space when few dare to claim they saw. Not all speakers were free of pressure. A servant questioned after a raid understands that power sits across the table. An overseer who has fallen from favor may speak to spare themselves. A neighbor may hope to win credit by giving strong words. The setting itself shapes what gets said and what is left out. Even so, fear can break silence. Pain and loss can pull truth to the surface. Some pages hold detail that sounds close to the scene. A maid says she carried ash from a hearth and saw a mark on a floorboard. A guard says he heard a door bolt slide twice. A clerk notes the time of a night watch. These small facts anchor the larger claims. They do not finish the case. They give it texture and place. A few statements try to count the dead. Numbers rise fast in stories told at a distance. A careful scribe marks a range rather than a fixed sum. Modern readers should take care here. A high number may reflect the scale of fear rather than a ledger kept at the time. What matters for this chapter is the way numbers travel on breath and are fixed by ink. The record also shows how certain names collect weight. Repeat a name often enough, and it grows heavy. That can mirror reality if the person acted. It can also reflect how one figure becomes the cup that holds general blame. Sorting between these two calls for caution, It calls for cross checks that the age did not always keep. By the end of the taking, the table held stacks of folded sheets with seals cooling in wax. The scribe had sore fingers and a mind full of pain he had not seen himself. The voices he wrote came from fear, duty, anger, loyalty, hunger, and hope. They came from upstairs corridors and from cottages beyond the walls. How do we weigh these accounts with fairness? Which lines carry the ring of a room, and which carry the echo of the road? The next chapter steps to the edge of the law of that time to ask what counted as proof and what remained only a claim. Chapter 4, What the Law Allowed. A table stood in the center of the chamber. Candles burned low. A clerk unrolled a sheet. A guard brought in a servant with bound wrists. The year was 1611. The questions followed the cadence of that court. Name. Service. Acts known or heard. The Kingdom of Hungary kept its law in a mix of custom and statute. Nobles held rights that set them apart. A countess could be investigated under the Palatine's authority. She could be confined by order. She did not stand before an ordinary bench. Servants and lesser people did. Depositions taken after the winter raid reached a county panel. Proceedings moved first against members of the household named in earlier statements. They were accused of acts that ranged from beatings to murder. Some denied. Some confessed. The court set sentences for those it found guilty. The countess did not face a formal trial. Palatine Georgi Thurzo and allied nobles placed her under tight confinement at Cactus. The stated reason mixed law and prudence. A public trial of a great lady could split factions and inflame the realm. Her rank allowed a different path. She lived the rest of her life under guard and restriction. The record of the servants' cases shows the tools the court used for proof. Sworn statements counted. Confession counted. Repetition of details across witnesses counted. Physical signs, when presented, carried weight, though the era did not keep the kind of forensic notes a modern reader expects. Torture to force confession was permitted in some settings. The use of force to produce truth stains the value of those lines now. It also belonged to the legal frame of that time. Several named women of the household stood accused as close helpers. One man of the household appeared as a fixer and enforcer. Sentences ranged from death to lesser penalties. Executions were carried out in public view. The court marked guilt as proven for those servants. It never entered a verdict for the countess herself. That line matters when separating allegation from what the court said in law. Lived voices in this chamber sound different from the hallways of the raid. A woman said she feared the mistress and obeyed orders to strike. A man said he restrained a girl at the command of a superior. Another claimed she tried to hide food for a servant and was punished. The court heard these lines and weighed them under the standards of its day. The clerk wrote dates and names. He summarized acts in a shorthand. He noted when a speaker changed a claim under pressure. He recorded when two accounts matched on a time of day or a room. He sealed the sheets for the county books. That is how proof traveled from mouths to paper. What did not appear in the county findings is also important. The legend of ritual bathing in blood was not the basis of sentence in these proceedings. The court did not write that image into its judgments. It spoke instead about beatings, confinement, and death in custody. It marked a pattern of cruelty as the frame. It did not mark a theater of ritual. Contrast the standards then with expectations now. Today, a court seeks physical evidence that can be tested and reviewed. In 1611, courts relied more on status, confession, and signed depositions. Jurists accepted coercion to reach confession in ways modern law rejects. That difference shapes every conclusion that can be drawn from these papers. The legal rights of nobility set the tone for the outcome. A countess could be confined by powerful men without a verdict. Her lands could be placed under administration while the case sat. Her servants could be tried and put to death. Her name could carry blame without the court ever writing the word guilty next to it. That is not a modern breach. It is the design of that age. Money touched the legal path. Estates under question were valuable. Credit ties to the crown made outcomes sensitive. The Palatine had to balance justice, stability, and the flow of rents and taxes. Confinement solved several problems at once. It removed a scandal from open court. It preserved order among factions. It allowed property to be managed while avoiding a spectacle. The absence of a formal trial for the countess leaves a hole in the record. Supporters of the harshest view fill that hole with the gravity of the servants' sentences and the volume of depositions. Skeptics fill it with warnings about torture, political motive, and gendered fear. Both sides point to the same set of papers and pull different meanings. One firm point stands. The court wrote guilt into the names of several servants. Those verdicts are part of the official record. Another firm point is that the Countess died in confinement without a verdict written by a bench. These are the proven edges. Between them lies the wide field of allegation, rumor, and later embroidery. What counted as proof in 1611 can never satisfy every modern test. It can still support careful claims if read with its limits in view. The safest ground is to keep the layers separate. Servants were tried and punished. A noble woman was confined. Many voices accused her of grave acts. The law of her time did not test those accusations in open court. That is the border of this chapter. The next step moves from courts to printers. How did a set of county papers and a confined noblewoman become a figure known across Europe? Who chose the images and the words that fixed her as a symbol of horror? The press and the stage will answer. Chapter 5, The Making of a Monster. The pressman lifted a form of type and locked it tight. The shop smelled of ink and glue. In the corner, folded sheets stacked in neat piles. Outside, the street in Pressburg moved with carts and boots. Inside, a story took on sharper teeth with every pull of the press. Those county papers had named rooms, servants, and dates. They did not draw grand scenes. In the 18th century, compilers and chroniclers began to add color. A woman of rank became a figure for warning. A house of discipline became a stage for horror. Writers claimed that the Countess sought youth through blood. A pamphlet turned a rumor into a fixed image. Preachers took the image to pulpits as a caution against pride and cruelty. Traveling storytellers repeated the tale to sell a night's crowd. Printers knew what readers bought. They leaned into shock, short lines, and a clear villain. A pattern showed across Europe. Men who killed in war or in private faced judgment, yet few were cast as eternal symbols. Women who held power met a different gaze. Tales of witches and cruel brides had set the ground for centuries. The Countess fit the mold that printers and readers liked. The bloodbath picture did not sit in the first records. It rose in later telling because it sold and it spoke to older fears. Parallels gathered. Bluebeard warned about curiosity and the cost of disobedience. Gillis de Rice stood as a dark example of rank joined to crime. Vlad Tepes turned into a staple of fear across borders. In this circle of names, the Countess became a ready emblem. The more the story traveled, the simpler it became. Nuance fell away. A single image did the work of a stack of files. Gender shaped the script. A strict noblewoman could be cast as unnatural. A mistress who punished could be branded monstrous. The same actions from a man might be read as hard rule. From a woman, they became proof of a corrupt soul. Printers did not write essays on bias. They set type that matched what buyers expected to read. The bloodbath motif fixed the story in an easy frame. It explained age, vanity, and death in one stroke. It solved the problem of doubt by replacing it with a picture. It also blurred the line between what courts wrote and what crowds wanted. Once the picture took hold, it pulled older facts into its orbit and changed how they were read. Some later historians tried to pull the tale back to the papers. They looked for dates, lists, and exact words. Others kept the legend alive for stage and screen. Museums faced a choice between drawing crowds and teaching caution. The two aims do not always sit in the same case. Chapter 6, Gold, Land, and the Palatine. The steward opened a coffer and lifted a packet of tallies tied with cord. Wax seals pressed against one another. A clerk read out rents due from villages on the Bathory lands. Another wrote the sums, then marked shortfalls in a tight hand. The room smelled of tallow and damp paper. Money set the rhythm. Across the realm, the crown drew on noble credit to feed war and keep the peace. Great houses lent and received. Debts crossed years and outlived men. The Bathory estates sat inside that web. When scandal struck, those ledgers did not pause. Rents still moved. Offices still paid. The Palatine Georgi Thurzo worked at the point where justice, order, and finance met. Voices near power left careful lines. A county officer noted that the estates required administration during confinement. A treasurer warned that arrears to the crown must not grow. A relative pressed a claim for guardianship over parts of the property. A pastor advised that poor tenants needed relief after a hard harvest. Each spoke from duty, interest, or both. Tension ran through the choices. Property under watch needed managers. Managers stood to gain influence. Creditors needed assurance. Assurance often meant control. The Palatine faced a public outcry over cruelty and a private map of bonds and favors. Confinement offered a path that kept papers moving and the realm calm. It also placed keys in the hands of allies. Confession split the land as well as the church. Confessional lines shaped trust and suspicion. Patronage often followed faith. So did slander. Charge and defense drew on the same soil of rivalry. A figure of rank under guard made room for old claims to rise. The halls of law and the rooms of account shared walls. Winners after the arrest came into focus with time. Some offices shifted. Some leases changed hands. Some relatives secured better terms for their lines. Villages felt the change in who took rents and who granted favor. The countess stayed in her rooms. The world around her moved on ledgers, seals, and oaths. Money did not settle the question of guilt. It did shape the route that followed the raid. A formal trial would have dragged debts, bonds, and factions into open court. Confinement kept most of that off the stage. The county still punished servants. The great lady remained under watch. Property passed through careful hands. Read the record with both truths held at once. A harsh household sat under grave accusation. Powerful men managed the fallout with attention to order and to accounts. Each step solved a problem and raised a doubt. Was justice the driver, or stability, or advantage? Often it was all three in one motion. The lesson is quiet and plain. When money moves, stories change shape. The next and final chapter turns to what remains on the page today, and how to speak of it without serving either myth or denial. Chapter 7, What Remains of the Record. A visitor walks the hill at Cactus on a clear morning. Stones hold the shape of walls. A small sign gives dates and names. Inside a museum room, a glass case holds copies of papers from 1610 and 1611. The past feels close and far at the same time. Modern historians return to those papers with care. They count depositions and trace who spoke, where and why. They mark which lines sound like a room and which sound like a road tale. They test the famous numbers and ask where each figure began. One claim repeats often. It speaks of a victim count, so high it numbs the ear. The path for that number is thin. It rests on a late line in a hostile setting. Some scholars caution that fear and rumor inflate sums when courts gather talk. Others say the scale of testimony still points to a pattern of grave harm. Both readings sit on the same stack of sheets. Archive gaps complicate the work. Not every ledger survived. Not every room was described well. Some pages were copied later. A few names shift spelling across documents. When the ground is uneven, a sharp claim should lean on firm stones. Where stones are missing, the honest word is doubt. Museums and films shape memory for the public. They must choose how to balance draw and duty. A lurid panel fills a hall. A sober label slows the step, but serves the truth. Curators and writers carry weight when they decide which lines to lift and which to leave in the file. Each choice sends a message about how we treat the dead and the accused. Gender returns in the retelling. A stern noblewoman becomes an easy villain in a culture trained to fear women with power. A narrative that once warned about pride and cruelty can slide into a simple picture that flatters old bias. Good history watches for that slide and names it when it starts. Ethics set the last frame. Victims, if we grant them in number and name, deserve respect. An accused who died without a verdict deserves clear lines between allegation and proof. The people who spoke under pressure deserve to be heard with care for the room they sat in and the risks they faced. No chapter earns the right to turn their lives into spectacle. So what can be said? Servants were tried and punished by their court. A Palatine confined a countess for the rest of her life. Many voices accused her of cruel rule, and worse. The bloodbath picture arrived later and sells the story beyond what the early record supports. Power, money, and faith shaped the path from raid to legend. The hill remains. The papers remain. The legend remains because it is easy to tell. The record remains because it is harder to read. A fair conclusion speaks in two parts. It accepts the gravity of the accusations and the harm named in sworn lines. It rejects the parts that rest on spectacle and the hunger to punish a woman for holding power. What should we pass on to the next reader? That winter night, those voices, and the limits of the page. The rest belongs to myth, which has its place, but not in the line where truth should stand.